Welcome to How I Raised It, the podcast that goes behind the scenes with entrepreneurs who've raised capital. We uncover the tips, tricks, and techniques they use to get investors to write a check. Strap in and turn it up.
Hi, welcome to another episode of How I Raised It, produced by Foundersuite.com. Today I have Keith George of Coedition coming to us from New York. How's your day going, Keith?
Everything's great. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, my pleasure. So what does Coedition do?
So Coedition is a multi-brand marketplace in the fashion space focused on women sizes 10 and above, which has been traditionally ignored in the fashion space. I've been in retail and fashion for almost 20, 25 years. And traditionally, brands focused on sizes 0 to 8 and just ignored the fact that the majority of women in this country are actually sizes 10 and above. And so there's about 100 million women out there, and they've had very few choices. And what's exciting is there are a lot of new brands that are starting up in this space, but no one has been bringing them all together under one roof and then showing this woman how to wear it. And that's what we do.
So it's, makes total sense, and I'm actually surprised that it hasn't been, you know, targeted more frequently, right? I mean, everyone knows how the shape of Americans' bodies are changing.
Of course.
Interesting. So are you purely a retail site? You're not curating or building brands yourselves, or are you?
Well, so right now we are a retail site where we bring all the brands together. So we have about 60 brands on the site. Mm-hmm. We'll have over 100 brands in the next few months. And we are a marketplace. So we work with the brands and actually feature them. We do a lot on size and fit, how to wear it, how to style it. And then we bring a lot of new brands that these customers traditionally have never seen before. In the past, there were a few players, mostly mono brand players like Lane Bryant that you might have heard of, or people would go to the department stores. But there's actually a lot of really interesting brands coming out of Australia, out of Germany, out of the UK. And so we're bringing them to this customer for the first time and then talking a little bit about, you know, if you love this brand that you're very loyal to in the US, then you should try these other brands. And it's all about, for me, you know, working with an underserved market. And these women really have, there's some great style out there. They just have a lot of options. And so we're bringing that to this market. Our price point is about $50 to $150. So think about a $100 dress. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, great quality brands. Just they haven't seen it before.
Interesting. And it's all sales, not rentals, right?
All sales, not rentals. Correct.
Yeah, I was going to ask, so what's the backstory? So you don't appear to be a plus size woman. Where did you come up with this idea? What were you doing before starting Coedition? Yeah.
It's a great question. And when we were raising money, you know, I got that question a lot. And my response is that, you know, no one ever told Jeff Bezos that he had to be a writer to sell books. Hmm. And if you look at the fashion space, Ralph Lauren, a man, Christian Dior, a man, all people, that what they really did was they just focused on the customer. And my background is more retail than it is fashion. Mm-hmm. And in retail, the thing that I learned early days, and I spent, you know, many years at Gap Inc. in California, was focus on the customer, understand what she needs, understand what she's missing, and serve her. And that's what I do. It has nothing to do with me, you know, creating a company where, you know, I say, oh, I was, you know, hiking in the Himalayas and my boots fell off, so I wanted to create a boot line that would never fall off. It was more about, you know, growing up and really focusing on serving someone else and making sure that we gave someone that wasn't being provided, you know, a service or value, that service.
Yeah. I think I saw, so you were at Gap, and then I think I saw Gilt in the background too.
Yeah. So I was at Gilt from 2011 to 2016. And interestingly enough, the idea for this business came out of that. When I joined, I'd been working at Gap in California and really wanted to do something more entrepreneurial. And interestingly enough, I was living in San Francisco and had been there 11 years, and the Gilt opportunity came up. And when I flew to New York from San Francisco, I met with Kevin Ryan, who, you know, is a famous serial entrepreneur who was the original founder of Gilt, also the founder of MongoDB, Business Insider, a co-founder of Zola. And I sat down with him in my first interview and I said, I'm here to learn from you. I will work so hard for you at Gilt. I will do everything I can for you. And when this reaches a natural point, then I want to do something with you. And that was in 2010. And then when we sold the business in 2016, I reminded him and we had a conversation, which and he was like, let's do it. And that was the genesis of how we got together to form Coedition.
Interesting. So he's your co-founder or?
He's a co-founder. So the team of Coedition, the four co-founders are actually all Gilt alumni. So it was myself. I was chief merchandising officer at Gilt. So I ran all of the businesses at Gilt, except for Gilt City by the end. So women's, men's, home, and kids. And then my co-founders, one was the fashion director and head of brand acquisition at Gilt. She's been in the industry 25 years at least. And then Kent Helbig, who was another co-founder, was on the technology team at Gilt. And then Kevin came in, and Kevin's whole point of view on investing is he wants to be, you know, in early with people that he knows and trusts. And so the four of us, you know, created Coedition. And I'm not sure if you've heard of Zola, the wedding registry site.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was a similar situation where Shan and Nobu, who were the original founders of Zola, teamed up with Kevin. Kevin wrote the angel check, and then they launched Zola. And I think they just raised at a really healthy valuation. So it's a great relationship that works.
I'll have to get them on the show. That'd be fun. I'll ping them. Zola. No, that's cool. And for people who aren't familiar, I mean, I remember Gilt. It was flash sales, right? And then what Correct. Was the ultimate exit? Who acquired them?
So Hudson Bay, Hudson Bay Corporation, who owned Saks and Lord & Taylor, ended up buying us in 2016.
Gotcha. Interesting. So when you went there, did you think I'm going to start a business after this business, or would it just come naturally, sort of organically?
It was something I always wanted to do. I had a family background that was a mix of corporate professionals and entrepreneurs. And I had been in the corporate route for a while, and it was always gnawing at me that I wanted to do my own thing and be a founder. And in 2010, 2011, I didn't have, you know, the idea sitting at, you know, right at my fingertips. And when the Gilt opportunity came up and I looked at Kevin's background and I looked at what Gilt was doing at the time and just being really innovative, that I said, this is a place, you know, I need to go learn from the best. And it ended up working out really well. And, you know, I'm later in my career than a lot of people in startups, you know, I have 25 years of work experience. But in this case, I really got a front row seat in a leadership opportunity to see a business grow and, you know, have all sorts of, you know, great opportunities come forward and then challenges as well. And all of that positioned me for where we are today.
What's your skincare routine? You don't look like you've been in the industry for 25 years.
I wish. I'm 47 years old. I got three kids. Like I'm barely hanging on.
Good for you. Good for you. Good stuff. Okay. So let's talk about fundraising. So when did you guys launch the business, and what was the early, did you, you know, put in your own money or bootstrap it, or how was the initially seeded?
So Kevin wrote the seed check, and so we had the seed check. It was written about a year ago, so October of 2017. We incorporated October 1st, 2017. We did a seed with Kevin, which the intention was, let's get the site built, let's get the branding done, let's get the, you know, the initial brands on and position ourselves to launch. And we did that, and then we had a lot of conversations about, do we do a larger seed round before launch or after launch? And that was a conversation we had. We ended up deciding to go out and test the market a little bit. And we went out in December of last year, which everyone said was just a crazy time to be going out. You know, the VCs on holiday, they're, you know, people aren't as engaged. And we had a few meetings that were okay, but not great. We weren't really prepared. But then things started to kind of heat up, and we ended up in about 4 to 5 weeks time from mid-December till the, you know, mid-January, end of January, we ended up with 6 term sheets. Wow. and a lot of interest and engagement from the VCs.
So let's dive into that a little bit. What created the momentum and the interest? It sounds like you had kind of a dream team or a pretty strong team that had worked together. The site was live, or the site was not live at that point?
The site was not live at that point. What everyone tells me is they look at, you know, the team idea and traction. And so I think because we were not live yet, I think that most people were focused on both the team and the market opportunity. Mm. As I was saying, you know, there's 100 million women in this country that fall into this category, and they have been completely ignored from a fashion standpoint. And when I look at a lot of traditional venture investments, I think they focus on really exciting, really sexy, really fun things that, you know, really take place on the coast, you know, hit hard in New York and then, or California. And that's great. But our whole business model is built on actually reaching that woman in Akron, Ohio, mm. or Plano, Texas, or Iowa. And so I think that was really interesting to the investors.
So you had of team, idea, traction, market opportunity. You had 3 out of the 4. Do you think it actually maybe helped you that you didn't have traction, like you were sort of pre-launch? Like if you had gotten in the market and had, you know, medium or moderate level of traction, maybe that would make the pitch harder. Sometimes it's almost easier when you don't have traction. You know what I'm saying?
I completely agree. You know, Kevin has a saying about, you know, well, pre-launch, you know, you're selling on the dream, mm. and after launch, you're selling on the data.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I definitely think that it helped us in this case. I'm really learning a lot about this customer in the sense of, for me in this business, and I think every entrepreneur should think about how their market will be on adoption. But for me, because we're reaching that woman in Akron or Plano, mm-hmm. it's a longer runway. And you know, with guilt was the type of thing where, you know, if you just focused on, you know, a few like epicenters of like very trendy women in New York, you could own that market quickly because they, you know, they talk a lot. They've got, you know, a lot of friends, a big network, and the whole thing just spread like wildfire. Mm-hmm. And so with guilt, it was like New York, San Francisco, LA, Chicago, boom. And then everybody else got on the bandwagon from there. With us, you know, we have customers so far in all 50 states. We've only been we launched in March. And we have customers in all 50 states, which is great. But it is not the same type of demographic as far as how the network works. And so for us, you know, launching the business when we did in March, I think without having, you know, data at the time, probably helped us close the round earlier, because, you know, early days of any company are early days. You've got all sorts of challenges, et cetera, that you have to address.
Yeah, interesting. So let's go into that just a little more. You know, you started talking to investors in December and then, you know, got 6 term sheets by the end, but what sort of happened in between those 2 data points to get the interest level? Cause this is what so many founders struggle with, right? It's like, yeah, I can get a few meetings going, but how do I get the momentum going on the deal? Anything you can point to? Yeah,
absolutely. So I think we went in with a very focused message, and we went in to a lot of meetings in a quick period of time with, mm-hmm. with focus. And we knew that we wanted to get the round open and closed quickly and not, you know, just drag this out and make it a months long process. And so when it was, you know, the middle of snowstorms, we mm-hmm. would make every meeting. We had meetings on Saturdays and Sundays with venture capitalists. We did whatever we had to do, because I think when you compress it into a time period mm-hmm. that you say, I'm going to open it here and I'm going to close it here. Yep. Then people know that they need to make a decision. If people don't need to make a decision, they won't make a decision, because every day that goes on, they get more data points.
Sure.
And as long as the deal is still on the table, well, why do I need to act? The deal's on the table.
Yeah.
And so, you know, in a way, it's kind of like dating, is that, you know, if someone's always going to be around and they're not going anywhere, well, you know, we'll see what happens. But as soon as they're like, well, I'm going on these other dates, you need to make a decision, then people kind of, you know, pony up to the table. And I think that was really important to us. And I think one of the pieces of advice that somebody gave me was, they're like, secure that first term sheet and everything will roll from there.
Mm-hmm. How many meetings do you think you had, or how many investors do you think you met with? Do you have any rough ballpark?
I do. We met at least 25, maybe 30 in a period of 30 days. So we had days where I was making the same, you know, kind of pitch overview, you know, four times in one day.
Yeah.
And by the end, I could just do it with my eyes closed. I didn't even need to, you know, even look at a slot.
Yeah, no, that's good. This is a theme I've picked up from doing these interviews is, you know, people who get it done fast, they're having 30 investor meetings in 30 days or sometimes even more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that requires people to like, to do the research, know who the funds are, know what you're trying to do. We ended up meeting and, you know, taking, you know, our lead investors were some of the big funds. But I also knew that some of the really big funds that were just not focused in our space just wasn't a good use of time. And so it's a strategy and an art. And I think, you know, planning ahead, if you say, you know, let's say you're going to say in 6 weeks, we're going to do a full court press. Mm-hmm. But you don't just start on the first day of the 6 weeks and be like, okay, who do we call?
Yeah.
It is listening to the market, knowing who's out there, you know, cultivating relationships. We had some relationships in advance through Gilt, through Kevin, through other people. We called in favors on with some friends as far as making some introductions. So then once we started, we were already in it and we knew what we were doing.
Do you think that was about 6 weeks of prep before that intense period started? Is that an estimate?
Maybe 3 weeks of prep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which is still actually fairly fast. I mean, that's a lot of work is involved in that, I know.
Yeah.
Okay. So something you mentioned said, you know, secure the first term sheet and the rest kind of falls in line. What did you do when you got the first term sheet? Did you go around to everyone else and kind of make them, you know, act or kick them out or what?
No, I think we were not interested in shopping term sheets. That was the one thing, is that we were not interested. I think it's really important that people understand that, like, it's a very transparent market. And when people are shopping term sheets, it leaves a bad taste in everyone's mouth. Mm-hmm. We had meetings that were set up. We knew that we wanted to understand where everyone's position was. But once the first term sheet came in, we didn't start adding meetings. We just kept the meetings that we had. But I do think that the market talks. Mm-hmm. And one of my biggest lessons in this whole thing is that the market talks, both good and bad. Mm-hmm. And P.S., they can talk. The market can be hot on you one day.
Yeah.
And then the next round, they can all be sour. And so it can play in your favor and play against you. And I remember saying, once we had this, you know, listen, one day the hero, the next day the zero. And don't get too cocky, because although it sounds like, oh, we're so great, we got six term sheets. No, that's not how it works. It is at the moment in time, there's an opportunity. People, you know, where there's a lot of chatter. And so we were very fortunate in that time frame. But, you know, it was a one-time thing. And you don't raise money one time. It's a long-term process. And so that was a real lesson for me as far as how it all played out.
But when you kept the meetings you already had, you didn't layer on a bunch more and try and create a feeding frenzy. But when you kept the meetings you had, would you go in saying, we have a term sheet, you know, happy to meet with you, but we have a term sheet? Like, you must have signaled somehow.
Yes. Mm-hmm. We did. We did say that we had that because we knew that we wanted to close the process quickly. Mm-hmm. And we also knew that we wanted more than one partner in the deal. And so we did communicate that, but we didn't try to bid up a price or anything like that. And we weren't doing kind of back channeling on that. But we were clear of where we were in the process.
One question people always ask, do you tell the investor you're meeting with who the term sheet's from, or do you just state we have a term sheet? Like, did you? Yeah.
We would just state that we had a term sheet. But the world is very small. And I think, you know, if I look at the venture community, most of these people either went to undergrad together or business school together, or they work within a few blocks. And so the back channeling that happens in the venture community is frankly amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's good. Good perspective. All right. And then I guess, if I'm looking at the notes, NEA led the deal. Is that correct?
Yes. NEA led the deal. Tony Florence, who is just a master investor. And then we had General Catalyst was in with Spencer Lazar and Addy Lerner there, who are amazing, amazing people. And then Ben Sun at Primary, who is primarily a seed stage fund.
Okay.
And then Susan Line from BBG, which is a fund that requires at least one female co-founder. Oh. And they came in, and Brooke kind of, who is one of my founders, obviously, fits that. And so it was really like a dream syndicate in that way.
Interesting, yeah. With the big guys, NEA and General Castle, I mean, those are big funds. Did you partly choose them because they have huge deep pockets for future rounds? And I guess the other part of the question is, you know, GILT raised a lot of money, right? Are you sort of, how does that impact how you're thinking about your future funding strategy? Multi-part right. question.
Yeah, great, great question. Well, so first of all, we had prior relationships with people at NEA and GC, and that definitely helped. I think, you know, we love the partners there. We love the people there. And it came down less about the name of the fund and more about the people that we were going to work with, because if it is not a transactional deal.
Yeah.
And the people at NEA, Tony has given me incredible advice. Charlotte, who's there, has given me incredible advice. Spencer and Addy, amazing. Ben, I mean, Susan, all of the people that were our investors are people that, frankly, I admire and aspire to be like. And because of that, when they speak, I really listen. And so that meant a lot to me. And mm-hmm. and I think even if we had had, you know, higher valuations or anything like that, I have a lot of respect for that, the people that we went with, and that feels good. I mean, there's always a challenge with the bigger funds in the sense of, you know, they have a lot of deals and they have, you know, big companies, and I need to be cognizant of the fact that, you know, I'm a small seed stage company trying to break out, and one day, you know, hopefully I'll be, you know, in a position to, you know, be one of the big guys. But in the meantime, you know, I need to respect their time too. So, so it's a give and take in working with the bigger funds.
Did you look, I don't know if those guys have a focus on retail or e-commerce, or, I mean, you guys have a lot of experience. Did that even matter? Do you need?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Tony did the Jet deal, and that was a big deal. And then General Catalyst has done a lot of things in the consumer space. And then Ben Sun, what I love about Ben at Primary was he was an operator. He was one of the leaders of Coupang, you know, out of Korea, which was a tremendously successful company there. And then actually Susan was CEO of GILT many years ago. And so, you know, deep experience in consumer, retail, e-commerce.
Cool. All right, a couple more questions and I'll let you get back. But what's your space like? Are you seeing some competitors emerge? Like, it seems like such an obvious, you know, pitch, right?
right.
Is it a deeply funded space? I remember like when flash deals turn out, like a lot of companies came up and, you know, got funded quickly and crowded in some ways. What's going on in your space?
Right. So right now we feel like we're in an interesting position, because when we launched, I was very nervous that we would have, you know, three or four people right on our heels. And because again, we're focused on this kind of 50 to 150 price point. So kind of think like a Bloomingdale's, like upper Macy's type Nordstrom price point. And someone launched right around the same time we did, but on the very, very high end, called 11 Honoré. We have a lot of respect for what they're doing, but it's just a very different customer. It's just like saying the Neiman Marcus Bergdorf customer versus the Macy's customer. They're just different people.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And then Dia & Co, which has been tremendously successful and is raised at a high valuation, is going after a different, slightly different customer than we are, more of kind of like the JCPenney, lower Macy's customer. And so in our space, you know, we feel like we're uniquely positioned, which we did not believe would happen. I believe if I were to go back and know what I know now, I wouldn't have launched the site for another 2 months, but I felt like we needed to get out. And what's fascinating about this market is people tend to bucket it as one thing, as plus size market. But the idea that you're going to categorize 100 million women as being all the same is just, you know, just not appropriate.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we feel good about where we're positioned.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's nice if your market sort of naturally stratifies like that.
Yeah.
So you're not just all fighting for the same market share. That's, yeah, that's nice. Cool. And it just, do you think this is going to take, obviously no one's going to hold you to what you're going to raise in the future, but do you think this is something that's going to take multiple rounds? Are you going to, you know, run this as lean as possible? Do you have any just general strategies on that?
Yeah. Yes. So we're definitely going to run as lean as possible. We're a marketplace. We don't take inventory. We use our vendor images. We keep it as lean as possible. I think this customer does not have a history of being served well. And I think that she needs options in the market. And so for me, we feel really impassioned about like how we serve her. And so I want to build a sustainable company that really can last the test of time. And so that to me is not about building, you know, a rocket ship to the moon right out that then like, you know, flames out later. And so I think for us, it's about being, you know, really thoughtful in how we do things and who we partner with in the future. And I think when one of the big lessons I had in these venture rounds is that, you know, it's almost like forget the name on the outside of the fund that you're raising with and think about the people on the inside and who you're going to be working with each day, because some people have a really long-term approach. Some people have a short-term approach. And I think two pitfalls that people get into are one is around just the valuation and what is my valuation? And I just want to get the highest valuation and the lowest dilution. And then the other thing is like, who's the cool, sexy fund that I'm going to be working with? And the fact is that, you know, Tony, Spencer, Addy, Charlotte, you know, all those people that I'm working with, they could be working at a fund called, you know, Blue Chair. I mean, who cares what the name of the fund is? They're incredibly sophisticated and smart investors. And those are the people that I want to be working with more so than like that I have a name on the building. But I've been learning so much in this process in the last 6 months. It's just been fascinating for me to see, you know, firsthand where, you know, how we've landed.
Do you think, and I haven't followed your space or this space that much, but I do remember some of those, you know, like I remember fab.com, that was like the fastest growing, hottest company in the world for a while. And then it wasn't. And, you know, do you think some of those flameouts has changed how you're thinking about things? It sounds like it kind of has.
100%. 100%. I mean, I think about this all the time is that, you know, if you and I decided that we were going to start a company and we were going to sell $1 helicopter rides to the Hamptons, well, you and I would be the most famous people in New York City. That doesn't mean we have a business.
Yeah.
That we'd be popular and everyone would love us. But, you know, when the money runs out, the money runs out. And in the end, if your job is to serve a customer that needs you, then you're letting them down if you run out of business and you run out of money and go out of business. And so I feel a real obligation to that. And that means really managing the money closely and then coming up with a business model that really, really works. You know, if you set off on this like terrible course where you're never going to make any money, well, just as you said, you're just going to have to raise money for the rest of your life because you're never going to make it. And what kind of business is that? That's not a business.
Mm-hmm. Is your business model, we didn't really talk about that. Is it purely just taking a commission or referral or markup or?
Yeah, we're not an affiliate. We are, we're a marketplace. So we take a commission and then the brand has, you know, certain obligations on their end, but we do market the product. The product is shipped in our boxes with our packing slips. We own the customer. And so, you know, we built in the right kind of a structure where it's a sustainable business.
Yeah. Great. Okay, great. This is really interesting. So anything, you know, the question we've covered a bunch of it already, but if you're going to go back and do this all over again, both on the startup, the launch, and the fundraising, what would you do differently, or any other tips that we haven't covered?
Yes. I mean, I feel like I've lived like 10 years in the last 7 months, and I'm doing so many things differently, but it's hard to know, of course, in the time, you know, what's going to happen. Again, I feel like we launched several months early, but at the time I just was worried to death that someone was going to launch before us and take the PR from us or get the momentum. I think from the fundraising round, really, you know, reminding yourself that, you're probably never as great as you think you are. You're never as bad as you think you are. And making sure that you like stay balanced in that process. It's a really challenging process. And just focus on the people that you're going to be working with. Focus on less. I can't tell you how much less I care about valuation now than I used to care about it. Because what I want is I want the funding to really help me, you know, get the business where I need to be. And I believe, you know, one of my best friends, who I think was on your show before, Whitney Casey, a finery.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
When I was going through this process, you know, she and I have been friends a long time, and she's gone through the process, and she just kept me so grounded in that. And it was one thing that she just taught me, as far as just like really evaluate the partners, really evaluate the people, really think about where you're going to take this business, and just not get caught up in the hoopla. At the same time, if things don't work out the way you want to, you know, don't get down either, because, you know, one of the, you know, main things that we have as entrepreneurs is our optimism and belief in success. Otherwise we wouldn't be doing it. But that's just really important to hold on to.
Yeah, it's good. Yeah. That's great stuff. Yeah. Whitney was maybe like number 5 or 10 or super early in our show. So I'll have to go back and see if.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, she's by far the most dynamic woman I've ever met in my life. So, I mean, I'm confident in her success. So I'm glad that she's on the show.
Yes. For everyone want to go back, it's Finery, right? Finery is her startup.
Yep.
It's pretty interesting. And she calls it the wardrobe operating system, which I thought was kind of a clever, like, pitch, you know.
Of course.
Yeah, cool. Awesome. Very good. Well, if people want to learn more, it's coedition.com. Good job. And do you have anything you want to promote, plug, talk about, anything upcoming, anything at all?
No, I mean, I think, you know, we're a week away from the Black Friday, Cyber Monday, and so we're going to be having a lot of things going on next week. But just for new customers, we have an ongoing promotion, New 20. And we'd love, you know, any kind of support. We'd also love your feedback as well. You know, we really just want to make this site better every single day.
Do you have a newsletter they should sign up for?
You can sign up on site.
Cool. Great. All right, Keith. Well, this is great. Thanks so much for your time. And we'll catch you after your next round. Appreciate it.
Awesome. Thank you. Have a great day.
Bye. Cheers.